We're going to be talking about two chapters, and there's quite a bit going on in those two chapters. So I want to start with this particular picture of the genie in the bottle. We can learn a lot from stories which go in popular culture. I don't believe in genies, and I don't believe they're stuffed in bottles, but you can get a good story from it. And so the story goes that this genie is trapped in a bottle, and he's been there for 100 years, and he decides in that 100 years that whoever releases him will get one wish. But no one releases him. And so he's there for another 100 years, and he decides whoever releases him will get two wishes, but no one releases him. And finally, he's been there for 300 years and decides whoever releases him will get three wishes, but no one releases him. Then he just gets angry, and he gets more and more angry, and he gets more and more angry inside there, and he says, okay, the person who releases me, I'm going to blast them, because I'm just so annoyed about being trapped in this stupid bottle. And the story goes, we'll take for this one, that Aladdin comes up and rubs the lamp and out pops the genie. And the genie's really, really angry at Aladdin and says, I'm going to blow you away, and explains the reason why. Aladdin sees he's onto a loser. And so he kind of goes, did you really spend all that time in that bottle? And the genie goes, of course I did. He says, all that time in that tiny bottle? Yes. I don't believe you can get in that bottle. Yeah, I'll show you, says the genie, and pops himself back in. And Aladdin sticks the lid back on. And then he says to the genie, I'll let you out if I get the three wishes. Bottling up your anger. That's what you can get from it, by the way. Don't bottle up your anger if you want to take something away from that. But more importantly, the last thing you really want to meet is someone who's really, really powerful and really, really angry. That's the last sort of thing you want. Now, we have in our world lots of powerful rulers. These three particular men probably hold the fate of our world in their hands. They are very, very powerful people. They control extremely powerful weapons and very big armies. They affect us in so many ways economically, and we've got to be, you know, fairly circumspect about how you treat their countries as well. Powerful rulers. And I raise them because Joseph was one of these men of his day. Egypt was the powerhouse. Joseph was in charge of it. And what Joseph said went. The only person who could ever overrule him was Pharaoh, and Pharaoh had the wisdom to be able to go, smart guy, let him do all the hard work. So when you're going to go and approach the person, I want you to put in context of the sense of fear and the sense of awe that this family coming down said, go get some food. They had to turn up and front one of these sorts of characters and say, I need your help. Well, Jesus teaches us and says, you've got to have wisdom when you're dealing with humanity, because humanity is sinful. And so you've got to be able to deal wisely with humanity. Look, Jesus says, I'm sending you out as sheep among wolves, so be as shrewd as snakes and as harmless as doves. Have wisdom. If someone's really, really powerful, don't prod them. Don't get them angry. Watch how you deal with the system. Another passage says, not everyone who calls out to me, Lord, Lord, will enter the kingdom of heaven. Only those who actually do the will of my Father in heaven will enter. On judgment day, many will say to me, Lord, Lord, we have prophesied in your name and cast out demons in your name and performed many miracles in your name. But I will reply, I never knew you. Get away from me, you who break God's law. In the ministry I have, I come across a lot of people, many who claim to be believers in Jesus Christ, and they may genuinely believe that, and I spend time watching them and figuring out their lives and saying, does what they're saying match what they're doing? Because if what you're saying is one thing, but what you're doing is something else, that starts setting bells off in me and kind of going, exactly what sort of believer in Jesus are you? And how would I entrust myself to you? And so, Jesus says, test the waters. Because of the miraculous signs Jesus did in Jerusalem at the Passover celebration, many began to trust in him. But Jesus didn't trust them because he knew all about people. No one needed to tell him about human nature, for he knew what was in each person's heart. We need to be wise when we're dealing with the world and we're dealing with sin around people's lives. I raise all of this because what I want to talk about is reconciliation. Joseph was a man who'd come to terms with forgiveness and seeks reconciliation with his family. Let's look at the story of Joseph, what he'd been, you know, sold by his brothers. He'd been accused of false sexual behavior, and so he'd lost the one role he'd got as head of the household. He'd been thrown in prison and ignored for a couple of years. And eventually, through God's graces, had been used and therefore put into a position of authority and power in Egypt. Now, the first thing he could have done is gone, right, Potiphar's wife, I'm going to get some payback here. Because he could have been powerful and angry. What's more, he's now in control of all of the armies of Egypt. He's doing a good job. There's no reason why he can't direct and do anything he wants. Could have gone, let's get some payback on my family. But he hasn't. What he consistently does is demonstrate God's characteristics. And all the way through, I would argue, if you read the story of Joseph and hear the account of who he is, he demonstrates quite clearly that he's a follower of Jesus Christ. Well, follower, in his words, of Yahweh. He demonstrates that characteristic. And he demonstrates that he wants to see God's will done. And over the period of time, he's figured out what's going to happen. 7 years, there are going to be a bumper harvest. And then there's going to start coming famine. But the famine's going to be worse all around the area and then start encroaching in on Egypt. But we're going to have food, so people are going to come to us. Joseph knows his family are going to be forced to come down here. It's going to be the only place of a source of food. He knows he's going to see the people again. The question is not, are they going to turn up? The question is, what am I going to do when they do turn up? And Joseph's come to the place in his life where he said, I'm willing to forgive for what's been doing. Because he's come to realize that God's plan was in place. He's come to realize that God had a more powerful use of his life by placing him in charge of the whole of the country. Yes, he had to go through pain. We know that he was around 17 years old when he was cast out as a slave. And we now know when he took over this place. It says in Genesis here. Sorry, I'll come back to that in a second. We know that he was around 30 years old. And so when he meets, after 7 years of a bad time and 1 year of, 7 years of good and 1 year of a bad, he's around 38 years old when his brothers turn up. From 17 to 38, he's not seen them. But he's come to the point of forgiving them in his heart. So forgiveness happens in your heart when you see the need to move forward in this expression of reconciliation. You see, we're called to forgive. I've talked about this before, I'll talk about it again. But I'm not here to talk about forgiveness today. I'm taking that as read. I'm taking that as read that he's gone to the position where he said, I've acknowledged they've done something wrong, but I've acknowledged that God's used that for a greater purpose. And so I'm willing to forgive them the sins that they have done. So now the question is not, do I forgive them? The question is, can I be reconciled to them? And what I want us to concentrate on is the difference between the two. Because forgiveness allows us to release the things which have been done to us. And it moves forward and it says, I want to see the person who sinned. I want to see them brought back towards God. But all that can be done without actually interacting with the person who sinned against you. Reconciliation takes the step which says, if given the opportunity, I want to try and restore in some manner whatsoever a relationship which may have been damaged or split apart or whatever else. So we're moving from forgiveness to reconciliation. And what he's going to demonstrate, what I'm going to draw out from this, is how he goes about it. But before we move on to what he's doing, I think it's an important part, and I've said this before, and I want to say it again. Reconciliation needs to be done from a position of safety when abuse has been involved. There's a practical aspect here and right now today. Many of you may have been in abusive relationships in one manner or format or whatsoever. And I would encourage you, as we are forgiven people, to come before God and let God work through your heart to allow you to forgive those people who did that abusive situation. But that doesn't necessarily mean you can be reconciled to those people. What you need to do is, if you want to seek reconciliation with people who may have caused abusive situations, or anybody really, is you need to do it from a position of safety. Never try and re-establish a relationship unless you are safe and secure. And what we see with Joseph is he's in the most powerful, safe position you're going to get. And what he does is he sets tasks for his brothers to test. Have they changed who they were compared to who they are now when I meet them again? Because when I knew them, they were jealous of me. They threatened murder. They sold me into slavery. And who knows what lies they told from there. I knew historically, before they'd done all that, that my eldest brother, he was fairly horrible. And my two older ones, two next ones down, they were fairly violent. As I said, he was 30 years old when he took over from Pharaoh and became the leader there and worked on Pharaoh's behalf. So, have they changed? Are they repentant? Well, let's just consider the history that we have of these characters. We have, We have Reuben. Reuben, if we remember, wanted to take over the family and decided to sleep with one of his father's concubines. That sort of got his father fairly angry, as you'd imagine it would. So Reuben was sort of discounted from leading the family. The next we have Simeon and Levi. Simeon and Levi told a few lies and eventually tricked a whole town into getting themselves circumcised so that they can then go in a couple of days later when all the males were in discomfort and unable to defend themselves and whipped in and slaughtered the whole lot of them. And then the rest of the brothers came in and stole all the goods. Sort of a vicious sort of way to go about stuff. That wasn't too impressive in their father's eyes either. This is the sort of characteristics they had. Although Joseph isn't aware of this, we are. We're told earlier that Judah, you know, great guy as he is, ends up sleeping with his own daughter-in-law because he can't keep his promises for his sons. Not the best sort of bloke either. So as you see, the characteristics of his brothers aren't terribly impressive. What are these people like? So he gets them come down, recognizes who they are, and asks them about what's going on. Checks out about their family. Tell me about your family. Oh, well, there was 12 of us. As you can see, 10 of us are here. The 11th, our youngest, he's back home with Dad, and the 12th is no more. Well, that's accurate. If Benjamin is still alive, Joseph doesn't know they're telling the truth. Are these guys still liars? Well, let's just test. You guys are really spies. That's how I'm going to treat you. No, we're not spies. Not spies at all. And actually, they've got a good case. If you're going to spy out the land, why would, in this particular case, Jacob send his entire descending group, bar one son, and send them as spies? Strategically, it makes no sense at all, does it? I'm going to take all of my family members and off you go. And if you all die in that raid, tough. Doesn't make any sense at all. In fact, their actual argument, well, why would we come down and do that? We're actually telling the truth here, stacks up. If you're going to be sending spies, you'd send one of you guys, wouldn't you? Or you'd maybe send one and a couple of people from other places. No, I'm going to put you in jail. I'm going to leave you in jail, and then one of you can go home and bring the other brother, and that way you can prove to me you're telling the truth. So they languish in jail for 3 days. If you wonder where 3 days come into play, we'll see it all the way through the Bible. God consistently sort of sets this system up so we get this idea that when Jesus is in 3 days in the grave, this isn't sort of like random numbers. He's making the point all the way through. So they're trapped. And then what happens is he says, right, well, I'm a God-fearing person. Now notice what he says, not a God's-fearing person, because that's what Pharaoh's is, and that's what Egypt is, it's all the gods. He says, I'm a God-fearing person. And because of that, I'm going to release you. But before that, he listens into them. Now, we know he's Joseph, because the text tells us. But the brothers have got no idea. He's now dressed as an Egyptian. He comes across as a powerful ruler. And he has a translator to translate everything through. And so when he speaks to the brothers, he will speak in Egyptian. The Egyptian will translate into Hebrew. And his brothers will go back and reverse through the process. There's nothing in their process to think, why would this be anything otherwise? And so what they do is they're discussing amongst themselves. Clearly, we're being punished because of what we did to Joseph long ago. We saw his anguish when he pleaded for his life, but we wouldn't listen. That's why we're in this trouble. Didn't I tell you not to sin against the boy, Reuben asked, but you wouldn't listen, and now we have to answer for his blood. Now, that's new news to Joseph because he wasn't around. He was in a pit where they were discussing this idea. He didn't ever realize that his elder brother spoke up for him. That's a revelation. Of course, they didn't know that Joseph understood them, for he'd been speaking to them through an interpreter. Now he turned away from them and began to weep. This is the first time we have recorded in Genesis people actually acknowledging their sin. Didn't I tell you not to sin? See? We sin. And they've also acknowledged that this is a punishment coming because of that sin. And you might think, well, so what? But actually, that's really significant because what they've done is they've grown from the position where they were so jealous to say, actually, we should have not done that. We realize we've done something wrong. Well, they're brought out of jail except for Simeon. He's left. Because Simeon's actually perceived as the ringleader behind all of it, sending Joseph, you know, sending him off to being sold into slavery. Simeon's thrown into jail, and the rest of them are sent home. And as they get home, they find that all the money they've been given or had left has been returned. And their father is now terrified, and when they all find this out, they go, oh no, look at this. All the money we took with us is back here. Now, if we go back down, even if we take Benjamin with us, the high chances we'll get accused of being thieves. And Jacob gets a report and says to them, what on earth are you playing at? Why did you go and tell them the whole history? And he said, well, they asked, what's the problem? How are we to know the guy's going to say, bring Benjamin down? And Jacob says, you're not taking Benjamin. And Reuben goes, well, tell you what. Let me take Benjamin, and if I stuff up, then my two sons you can kill. Now, I'm not entirely sure why asking a grandfather to kill his two grandchildren is actually helpful in a manner to sort of protect his other son. It seems to me a sort of ridiculous statement, but it's a very Reuben sort of statement because he thinks violently. He doesn't actually think much at all. And what you'll notice is Jacob ignores him entirely. Because Reuben's lost all standing. Now, you'll also notice in the earlier chapter we read that he's always called Jacob. It's one of the clues. Tends to be, not always, but tends to be when Jacob's called Jacob, he's thinking carnally and for himself. But when he's called Israel, then God's really got hold of him and he's starting to think again as he's meant to. So at the moment, nah, not sending my son down. Fair enough, dad's in charge. You also notice at the start of that chapter, he goes, effectively, what are you all doing standing around looking at each other? Go and sort it out. This is a guy who rules the roost. He's really in charge. And so he should be. Anyway, the next chapter finds them all starving again because they've all languished around. They cared so much for Simeon, they've just left him in jail for I don't know how long. What about Simeon? You think, oh, well, never mind. Until the food's all run out. Go back and get us enough food. Take the best produce of the land that we have got, stuff that you can't get in Egypt. We'll take the best of what we've got left, take it down as an offering. They'll really appreciate it. And they do. There's certain things that you can get in Israel that you couldn't in Egypt. And that's what trade happens. Go back down. Take the 10 bits of gold, sorry, of silver that you were taking, and take double. 20 pieces of silver, actually 20 bags of silver to be effective. 20 bags of silver. Take 20 bags of silver to say how sorry you are. And it might occur to the brothers that they got 20 silver pieces for selling Joseph. God's making sort of points in their life. Have you got this, guys? Do you realize what you caused? Maybe the 3 days you spent in jail might make you think about the terror that you put your brother through. And then we come to this promise, which is made by Judah. And he says, well, tell you what, let me take Benjamin and I will be responsible for him. And we see here Jacob go, okay. So we see the passing of power. Bypasses Reuben, everyone ignores him. Simeon, no one cares about him, they left him in jail. Levi's the next one down, bypassed him. Judah. That's the leader of the tribes. And you wonder why the Lion of Judah? That's where it comes through. And so Judah says, I'll make this promise. Okay. Israel accepts. Jacob refused. But now in this chapter it talks about Israel. Israel accepts. Go and do this. This is, by anybody's standards, a dysfunctional family. I can't speak as your families of origin, but this one is not a good one to sort of like take lots of lessons on how to do things properly. But it should inspire you that if God can work through this bunch of people and produce such a marvelous outcome as Jesus Christ, there is hope for each and every one of us. Well, it's interesting that Jenny read that particular passage just before I came up, because one of the things I wanted to talk to you about is how God uses circumstances to change entrenched positions within us. Romans tells us that likewise the Spirit helps us in our weakness, for we do not know what to pray as we ought, but the Spirit himself intercedes for us with groanings too deep for words. And he searches hearts and knows what's in the mind of the Spirit, because the Spirit intercedes for the saints according to the will of God. And we know that for those who love God, all things work together for good, for those who are called according to his purpose. We are going to find ourselves in naff circumstances. Things are not always going to be perfect. We live in a world where evil exists, where an enemy, a physical real enemy called Satan, exists and sets himself against the people of God. And so we're going to experience that. But we also trust that God is so powerful and so amazing that even in bad circumstances, God's will can be enacted. And what we need to do is learn from those situations and say, what is God trying to teach me? Simeon, sitting in jail for I don't know how many weeks to months he was down there, probably needs to sit and go, I wonder what God's trying to teach me sitting here. And maybe Simeon should have a bit of empathy and go, I wonder what Joseph felt like as we'd sold him off to those slave traders. Is this what it's like to be left alone and isolated from your family? God uses circumstances to alter our entrenched positions. Simeon's got a long time sitting in jail because he needed most of all of the brothers to actually appreciate the sin of what he'd done. But each and every one of us may well find ourselves having circumstances which we wish we could avoid. But God's using them to say, you need to change your position. You need to get out of where you were. You need to change that attitude in your life and come forward with the one which more reflects my character. So rather than sitting there kind of going, God, why are you doing this? Maybe we should be looking and say, God, what are you trying to teach me through this? How can I approach what's been put upon me in this situation? I'm sure, I don't know, many of you have been through the process of losing your job. And having gone through that a couple of times myself, you go home, you sit down, you look at your family and you go, oh no, what next? How do we do this? Why did I go through that situation? What did I do wrong? What I could have done differently? All sorts of things pass through your mind. And it'd be great to say, and then you kind of go, oh, God's taking it on control. And then next day you're fine. It's not. You work through it. But you eventually come to the point where you realize as a believer in Jesus Christ that even in difficult circumstances, he's teaching you something. In that particular case, it may be to trust. Well, they arrive back. They arrive back and they kind of come back and they go to his steward and they say, hey, listen, we turned up, you remember us, and when we were heading home, we found all the silver that we'd left with you. And the steward says, hey, don't worry about it. I got my silver. You're okay. Be cool, guys. And so they're brought back into the place. And they have this meal set before them. There's three tables set. There's a table set for them. There's a table set for the Egyptians. And there's a table set for Joseph. Because even though the Egyptians appreciate the fact that Joseph's in charge of the whole place and that he's doing a great job, he's still a Hebrew, so we're not eating with him. Not quite accepted as much as he could be. And so they have a setting and Joseph sets his brothers in order from age down, from oldest to youngest. Having brought Simeon out, reunited them, given them all new clothing, set them there. One statistician's worked out that statistically there are 40 million ways of placing 11 people at a seat. I don't know if that's right. I'm not that good at maths. But it's a fairly high chance of, unlikely chance of just statistically going, getting it perfectly done. Of course, when you know all your brothers, it's not a chance at all. It's dead easy, isn't it? But they're amazed. They're amazed that this ruler just looks at them all and goes and sets them all through. But still, nothing's twinkling at all. Not a thing. And then Benjamin's there. He hasn't seen his full blood brother for all this time. His older brothers were the ones who sent him away, not Benjamin. This is his younger brother. So the first thing is, they were telling the truth. He's alive. But it also means they didn't go and kill Benjamin. They didn't just wipe out that side of the family. So let's see, how do they react? So he feeds them all food and gives five times as much to Benjamin. Are you still jealous? Is the question he's asking. Because Dad gave me a coat and Dad put me in charge because he recognized that I had these things from God. And you lot were all jealous and your response was to try and do me in. Are you still jealous? Have you matured beyond that? And they have. They're not upset, they're not angry, they are amazed. And at this point, we've left the text. That's the end of our text for here. But we'll come on to next chapter, what he does as the final test for reconciliation. The Bible tells us, recorded in Mark, but when you're praying, first forgive anyone you are holding a grudge against, that your Father in heaven will forgive your sins too. So back to the first statement what I said about this, that Joseph could have been an angry man, but he's come to a position of forgiveness for the things which have been done against him. Each and every one of us should be coming to a point in our life where we're standing before God and saying, God, I have acknowledged that this sin has been in my life. Will you please forgive me for it? And the answer should come back to us, of course I will. Have you forgiven the person who you're holding that grudge against? Because what's the point of you coming before me, the living God, and saying, forgive me my sin, but do that person in over there? Because God says it's not the way it works. You need to see forgiveness flows down. And if you're asking for forgiveness, as you should, then you should be granting it to others. First, forgive anyone you're holding a grudge against. Continues in Matthew. So if you're presenting a sacrifice at the altar in the temple, and you suddenly remember that someone has something against you, leave your sacrifice there at the altar and go and be reconciled to that person, then come and offer your sacrifice to God. See the two sides? God, forgive me. And he says, well, listen, if you're holding a grudge, you've got to forgive them. But if you're coming with sacrifices and you remember someone's got something against me, go and reconcile it. And generally, if someone's got something against you, it's probably, statistically speaking, because you've done something wrong. So once again, what Jesus is using, saying before you can come and bring a sacrifice and expect this sacrifice to be accepted by God and the blood within it to cover over who you are, go and do the practical part of sorting out the relationship between you and another person. Now that's challenging for all of us. If nothing more, you take away from this two things there, which is if you want to have forgiveness, go forgive other people. And if you want to have forgiveness, go and be reconciled by seeking forgiveness. Offer forgiveness, seek forgiveness. And by the way, when you seek forgiveness, it's not a drive-by. Oh, sorry, I did that. Back on. Okay. It's coming before the person and it's humbly acknowledging them and it's saying to them what you did. I'll pick up someone and wake them up. Terry, mate, you don't realize it, but the other week I said something about you to somebody else and I realized afterwards I probably shouldn't have done. I gossiped about you. Will you please forgive me? And so I've spoken to the person directly. I've told them what I've done. I've acknowledged my sin, what specifically it was, and I asked for their forgiveness. Will you please forgive me? And I now wait. And now it's upon Terry to make a choice, isn't it? If I go, hey, Terry, I gossiped about you. Sorry about that, mate. It's really not really interactive with Terry at all. He has no choice. Come and ask for forgiveness. And assuming Terry does that, we've got a basis for reconciliation. All right? Which brings me back to the point of what I'm getting at through the whole of this. I'm taking it as read that as believers in Jesus Christ for this particular sermon, you understand that we need to be forgiving people. We need, as a standard way to explain ourselves and go through life, of being a people who will forgive others. But then we also need to take it beyond that, and we need to be a reconciling people. We need to get back together with people. We need to re-establish relationships. And you just have to take a few minutes within the New Testament to watch Jesus and how he does this over and over again. And he brings people back to reconciliation. You know, the only time he gets this person who's got so many demonic entities inside him, he's called Legion. And then he says, out, and he casts them all out. And there's this person who'd been ripping chains off and biting people and doing all sorts of horrific things in his area. And he gets them and the whole people turn up and they find this demoniac, now calm, peaceful, without the chains, sitting there. And Jesus goes, yeah, there he is. Go back to your people. You actually got to understand what he's just done there. Who knows what horrendous things this guy did whilst under the power of the demonic? Who knows where he beat people up or destroyed them or called them names or even worse things than that? And Jesus goes, well, he's different now. Be reconciled together. Simon the Zealot was a terrorist, basically. That's what you call a zealot. He was a terrorist working in his mind for the Jewish cause to bring freedom for the Jews. Matthew the tax collector worked for the Romans, the guy Simon the Zealot was trying to throw over. You couldn't get two more polar opposites for Jesus to go, yeah, I'll put them on my dream team. But he brings reconciliation because he says, you've done sinful things and you've done sinful things. And if you want forgiveness, then the outcome is reconciliation. And so as Joseph does with his brothers, he starts with a position where I've already forgiven them for what they've done. Now what I want to do is bring reconciliation to them. And so I'm urging all of us, the next step is to do reconciliation. But do it from a place of safety, particularly if there has been abuse involved. And it's fine to test the waters. That's what he's doing here. And what we'll find is, in my understanding, is that the brothers have changed. And so therefore reconciliation can take place. And what he's doing is he's testing the waters to see if they've changed their position and behavior. So having been in jail, they understand what it's like to be in jail. They've acknowledged their sin. They didn't do it to him, but they did it to each other. They've acknowledged where their sin was. They kept their promises. They brought their brother down. And we know that they're now promising their own lives to protect Benjamin, as opposed to we're going to do Benjamin in for the bettering of our lives. We've seen that change of behavior. And when Benjamin is acknowledged as more important, getting five times the food of the brothers, rather than being jealous, they're amazed. So that we're having the virtually all these sorts of things, the attitudes change of the brothers. And so Joseph knows there's a good chance now I can be reconciled. He's tested the waters and he's seen the right attitude. And so what I encourage you to do is test the waters to see if there can be reconciliation between you and people you have forgiven. Find out if they've changed. Set something for yourself and say, well, how do they manage this? How will they deal with that? That's what having the wisdom of Jesus does in a world which is surrounded by evil. We don't just go, cheap grace, you're forgiven. End of story. That's not the way Jesus works. Nor do we go, I just don't want to have anything more to do with you. That's not necessarily the way Jesus works either. The challenge is to move from forgiveness to reconciliation, but to do it wisely. And what Joseph does is give steps and examples of how he goes about it in his particular family situation. I said next week we'll come to the final step he does. What I want to encourage us all here to do is to say, is God calling me after forgiving people who may have sinned against me to bring reconciliation with those people? And I'm encouraging you that if that's what God's put upon your heart, to do so wisely from a place of safety, test the waters. And then let's see how God can move in those broken relationships to say, let's bring healing and let's see the glory of God brought forth. Thank you.